Amanda, overall chairperson in 2011, will read the traditions.
I'm Amanda, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Amanda. We're doing a mic swap. We'll do that later. 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is our group's 24th anniversary, for which we have a special format. Peggy will give us a brief history of the group, followed by an information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 45 minutes. Please help me welcome Peggy, co-founder and the overall chairperson in 1995.
What makes me think I don't need a cane? I don't need a cane. My name is Peggy. I'm an alcoholic. Thrilling to be here. And now the history of the Atlantic Group. Many groups start with a resentment and a coffee pot. The Atlantic Group did not. We had started with a dream that we would give the ultimate message to our newcomers so that they would keep coming. We also had some good examples. We had Clancy and Pacific Group. Now, I was blessed with having been one of the founders, along with Van, who passed away 12 years ago. Actually, last week was 12 years. Van was, without a doubt, the Atlantic Group's shepherd. The fellowship we chose 24 years ago has grown up around us. Our big book makes that promise. It was March 1st, 1994, and we met for the first time at the Convent of the Sacred Heart, 91st Street and 5th Avenue. God. I had scouted the location and chose it because we would be meeting in the recital hall, which had red velvet cushions and gold gilded frames. They forgot that they had rented the hall that night, so they told us we could meet in the library. The library had a capacity of 75 people, and we were about 100 that first night. In our fifth year, they asked us to hold our attendance to 75. We were too big for the hall, and because we were 200 at that time, we could not do that. So we went on a search for a larger space. Thankfully, we relocated here to Christ Church, and happily, may we say so. Oh, good. Better, right? Better. Okay. Should I start over? No. Okay. Our meeting history, for those that don't know. On February 1st, 1996, we started our second meeting. It was the Big Book Study, and it now meets on Wednesdays. On July 1st, 1998, our third meeting, It was the beginner's meeting, which now meets on Thursdays. Wonderful meeting. On January 7th, 2000, our fourth meeting, Steps and Traditions, was launched and meets on Fridays on the West Side. On October 13, 2002, we started our fifth meeting, The Call Up, which meets on Sundays. Diana is responsible for that, and she's here in the audience tonight. I have to give her a little shout out for that. On February 28, 2005, we began our sixth meeting, the 11-step meditation meeting, and it meets on Mondays. On February 16, 2008, our seventh meeting, which is a two-speaker meeting, and it meets every Saturday. Now, Van gave this history talk every year until 2006 when he became too ill and asked me to take over. Here's what Van read on our 10th, and it's as relevant today as it was then. On Saturday, I came across his handwritten note to me saying he had jotted down some notes in anticipation of our 10th anniversary. And here's what Van wrote. What has grown here is loyalty and responsibility to the home group and a sponsorship ethic which stresses AA's program of recovery. A desire to do service and to support our service branches with time and money. We have maintained the structure that we developed here, and as a direct result, we have flourished. But I will tell you why we are 10 years old. I remember he was doing the right time. Enough of you are willing to give up for the time you spend at an Atlanta group meeting, your personal desires, even your demands. Give up your individual, may I say, rights. That for at least while you attend an Atlanta group meeting, you follow consciously or not the first tradition. The group comes first and the individual second, albeit a close second. That you are obedient to avoiding the use of street language, dressing according to our dress code, and following another tradition, our primary purpose, carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is you, the individual member, being loving and tolerant of your group that makes it work. It is because you make that sacrifice that we are here tonight, celebrating 24 years. And if you keep that up, if you remain true to the group conscience, retain the structure, follow the traditions, especially AA's singleness of purpose, you will meet 20, 30, and maybe more years and fill the room with AA music, laughter, and the sharing of love for one another, our fellowship, and especially our group. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic, and I was overall chairperson in 2010. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The baskets will now be passed. Your contribution covers the expenses of our group and also that of our New York Intergroup Office, AA General Service Office, and AA Area Committees. Thank you for your ever-increasing contributions. For sponsorship, see Jennifer and William. We would like to extend a special welcome to newcomers and help you find a sponsor and answer any questions you may have about sponsorship. We have books listing available sponsors. If you need a sponsor, we have names and numbers for you. A sponsor is someone who has paved the path for you. We encourage you to take advantage of that. And please attend our beginner meeting Thursday at 7 p.m. in the church on 74th Street. I would like to introduce Dayton, who was overall chairperson in 2003.
My name is Nye, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not Dayton. So I have the honor of reading Becca's blurb. For those of you that did not know the lovely Becca, she was one of the first younger people to join our group and was our group chair in 2000. Becca passed away in May 2007, and she is sorely missed. She was well-respected both in AA and in the financial services industry and was certainly the epitome of Atlanta group attire. As part of our ongoing effort to illuminate what is Atlanta group attire, we asked Becca to write a piece for The Scoop, our quarterly newspaper. In the early days, showing up in dress attire was a sign of respect when meeting others in public. Many of us have experienced that inability of being able to suit up and show up for life. Dressing in Atlanta group attire for commitments such as speaking allows us the ability to show others that we respect our host and our responsibility of representing AA and our home group, the Atlanta group. One way we represent our recovery is by how we suit up and show up for the world. Becca H., 2000 Atlanta group chairperson. And as usual with the Atlanta group, the topic of Atlanta group attire returns for discussion again. And as a bit of an A nerd, I dove into the archives, and there was actually a lot of material there for Atlanta group attire. And we had, for clarification, it was agreed in 2006 that the custom of the group has been to wear Atlanta group attire whenever, anywhere and anytime we speak in AA, whether it is a formal Atlantic group commitment or not. This includes front of room service at the podium. And then so Becca's quote was updated in 2011 to read, also representing AA in our home group means wherever we do service, Atlantic group commitment or not, we wear Atlantic group attire. As a Atlantic Group home group members, we follow all of Atlantic Group's customs wherever we go in AA. And there was everything from discussion of when we're at the beach meeting, when we're at the Wilson House, when we're like, so it's been a hot topic. But our group conscience, is now super clear. So when speaking in front of the group or on behalf of the group, men wear jackets and ties. Women, comparable business attire. That was actually addressed. What is comparable business attire? No jeans, no sneakers or flip-flops for either. Atlanta group attire is not necessary to attend any of our meetings. I look forward to seeing you around the AA campus in your Atlanta group attire. And next up is Dayton.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dayton. There are many AA conventions and activities which we take part in. For flyers and more information, see our festivities person, Luz and Jordan, at the piano after the meeting. We celebrate AA birthdays on the last Tuesday of the month. If you are a member and wish to share with us, please confirm with the anniversary chair, Sophie and Eric. After the meeting, if you would like to become a member of the Atlanta group, please see our membership person, Breck, and the membership team at the piano after the meeting. Anniversary watch. In an effort to promote unity and enhance sobriety, we here at the Atlanta group sponsor an anniversary watch. This is an opportunity for Atlanta group members on their 365th day to sit with their sponsor, Atlanta group members, I think it says friends, and friends beginning at 9 p.m. to wait and watch their first year of sobriety be ushered in. Anniversary watches take place at the Mansion Diner on 86th Street and York Avenue. And we have no watches this week. And I would like now to introduce Stephanie, who was the overall chairperson in 2013.
Hi, Stephanie, an alcoholic. Go 2013. Are there any people visiting from out of town who would like to introduce themselves? And we're going to start on my right. Any visitors from out of town? No? Anyone on the left-hand side visiting from out of town? Yeah? No? Clancy. Hi. Thank you. Hi. Hi, Tyler. Anyone else? Upstairs? Anyone in the wings? Visiting? Please check the literature area for more information in our newsletter. There are books for sale and pamphlets are free. CDs of tonight's meeting can be purchased from April and Zach at the audio table at next week's meeting. As was said, this meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see here remain here. If you're speaking in another group and wish some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. Our main speaker tonight is Clancy.
No time for the meeting now. My name is Clancy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this evening, safe and sane and sober. And be here for the 24th anniversary. I guess I've been in every anniversary except one when I was sick. I was dying. I died later. But is our starting time inconvenient for you? And there's an ex-secretary, too. Oh, you were busy, she says. I was Van's sponsor, and he and I used to talk on the phone about starting this thing, and I'm in Los Angeles. You're going to horse around with this microphone all night, Stephen? But I remember when this meeting started, and we were trying to think of a name for it, and it was kind of an offshoot of the Pacific Group, so it became the Atlantic Group. And our Pacific Group in Los Angeles is about maybe three times bigger than this. So if you're ever in Los Angeles, come by and join us. We won't have any readings to tell you how wonderful we are, but we'll read chapter 5. And I want to tell the gentleman who read the 12 steps tonight, I see over there an ex-director, ex-manager of the World Service Office sitting here trying to make up for lost time. And his daughter. But anyway, I started to say something that was very important too. Well, whatever it is, it was important. I just, last July, I woke up one morning and I had turned 90, and I couldn't believe it. I still can't get my head around that, 90. So I'd prefer if you'd just take a love offering. That would be a little better than applause. Several of us have been down to a convention at the Lollapalooza in Philadelphia. It's only about 30 miles from Philadelphia, out in New Jersey. And I started my talk there by saying something rather important. I should say it here. That now that I'm 90, I used to kind of like to go to meetings and hit on the pretty girls and just... Now I'm reduced to saying things like, hi there, does your grandma put out? You know, it's not quite the same flavor. Oh, now Peggy's going into her emergency book. And then next year when you give your announcements, you can say, well, on our 21st anniversary, we had a foul-mouthed old sumbitch here, but he's not here today, but I'll be here. Our group is, I believe it's about 60 years old, 55 years old, and it has run much the same as this insofar as we have elections for the sponsors and we do all the things that we don't announce speakers and we don't do, but we do pretty well all in all. I was at the World Service Office yesterday, had lunch there, and I don't know if they do it here. Do you put in a dollar for your birthdays?
Yes.
We do that, put in a dollar for our birthdays. So yesterday I was able to drop off $10,000 from our group last year. And what do you think of that, George? More than you ever got. But it's really a conditional thing. And if you're kind of new tonight, I'm sure this is all kind of foreign to you, but Alcoholics Anonymous is not really that old. It's 82 years old. And 82 years ago, there were two sober drunks we know of. Now there's 2.5 million spread all over the world in 164 countries. And I think that's really a remarkable achievement, because there's nothing that keeps it going except one-to-one, talking and talking to get their attention. I think probably the greatest single problem for anyone coming to AA is coming to believe that I'm really an alcoholic. Oh, I drink a little too much, but I'm not really an alcoholic. As though there's a definition. There's no definition of an alcoholic. But you can look in the mirror tomorrow and see one. But alcoholics are people who have lost control over their drinking. As our first step says, we've lost control over our drinking, over our... And the steps of AA are designed to teach you a lesson that stopping drinking doesn't help. Everybody in this room has stopped drinking time after time after time, I'm sure. We've all stopped drinking, sworn off with or without a solemn oath, as the book says. But we don't stay off. And I had a hard time believing I was an alcoholic. I was in and out for 10 years, and I wound up in a little club on the west side of Los Angeles on the dead run from Dallas. I was trying to get to Seattle. I never got there. I'm glad I didn't. I wouldn't have fit in Seattle either. Now I'd had to go to Aleutian Islands or someplace, and they'd put me on a big floe and shove me off in the ocean and wave goodbye. But I wound up there, and I was doing very poorly. Just a week before, I was working in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South, writing the conversations between Elsie and Elmer, the Borden cows. But that morning I was thrown out of the midnight mission in downtown Skid Row. I was turned away from the Red Cross blood bank. It was raining, and I had to get out of the rain, so I said to some guy, where's the nearest club around here? Because you're told as you're around A that if you really get desperate, you can find a club. And they said, well, it's easy to find it. You go up this street, cut over to Wilshire, then walk west till you get to Fairfax. And on this corner back here is the club. And I did that. Doesn't sound bad, does it? 7.5 miles in the rain. Makes you proud to be an AA. And I got there, and I almost didn't go in, because there's a guy in the doorway, the kind of person that always made me crazy in AA. He said, welcome home, son. I thought, oh, screw you. And I didn't want to go in. But I went in, and that was October the 31st, 1958, which is a long time ago. I had no idea that would be my sobriety date. Or here's a girl that's missed all the readings. Now she's going to go home. She's mad. The only reason I come is for the readings. But I stayed sober, much to my surprise. I wound up living in an abandoned car in the A Club parking lot through the certain spiritual fallout. And I went to meetings every night, and I just had my front teeth up. I should tell you one more thing before someone notices it. I fell down about a month ago in my backyard, running up the driveway, and I got a concussion and bleeding. But worst of all, that tooth came out. So I got a replacement the next day for that. And just last Wednesday, some goof that I sponsor gave me some sticky mass to chew. I took out, there's my tooth. So I have to wait to get home tomorrow and get it replaced again, then I'll send you pictures. But I had just had my front teeth, when I got sober in AA, I just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank, because I'd vomited on somebody's bunk, turned out. He was ill-mannered, and he kicked out my front teeth. And I was on a dead run from Dallas then, just trying to get out of Dallas, because I was hotter than a firecracker. They wanted to take me back to the nut house there. And I didn't want to go back to the nut house, because I had a hard enough time getting into it. I had to commit suicide successfully. It's nice to have a successful suicide once in a while to talk. But I felt very bad because I was feeling bad. I was on the wagon, and I didn't know that being on the wagon is the worst part of alcoholism. I was on the wagon, and I felt bad. And I went to bed at night, and I got up in the morning. I felt so depressed and bad. I was trying to get out to the kitchen to just get a cup of coffee. And I went out there, and there was no coffee. A note on the table for my wife. I've taken the children to church. And I, damn it! Because I'm not a very kindly person. So I decided to kill myself. If you had the problems I had, you'd want to kill yourself too. And I went out to my car, and I put a hose from the exhaust pipe into the car. Let me tell you why that is. If you don't do that, if you just get in your garage and turn the motor, the car will die before you do. Then you have to face it. So what you have to do is run a tube from the exhaust into the car, so the car doesn't have to smell the same stuff you're smelling. And I died. And a guy next door apparently was watching all this through his breakfast nook. He said, what's that guy over there doing now? And he came over and found me in the car dead. And he pulled me out, and they beat on my chest and got the ambulance there and all the people. And they put me in the jail while they examined my case. And 2 or 3 days later, they came to the conclusion that I was dreadfully emotionally immature. I wouldn't have been if they'd let me alone. So they committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period, which is rather an overkill, I think. And I went to the nut house in Texas. And I'd like to say this, I said this to the other group too. If you must go to the nut house, try to go to some in big city nut house, because at least they have someone to draw their attendance from. Small towns are just big dummies, and makes it very difficult. And I got there, I remember the first night I was there, I felt so bad. I'm a brilliant guy. What am I doing in the nut house? And just lay down to go to sleep, and from somewhere around me came, ah! But you get used to the nightly scream after a while. And I was in that nut house for a long time. One of my stays in El Paso, I'd been on the faculty of the University of Texas at El Paso, and I did the staging of a grand opera called Mephistopheles by Arrigo Boito, a version of the Faust legend. And they saw that on my record. And so in 1956, I was called upon to direct the Christmas pageant at the Texas Nut House. Not very complex, just try to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly could. First one to worship her clients, eh? Then after that success, I started a little newspaper where I believe I started the slogan, "We're all here because we're not all there." But they only one issue went to press. And later on, I wanted to get out of there. And the state of Texas obliged me. One of these big attendants came up and said, "Well, boy, you seem to be getting a little nervous. Don't ever try to escape from here. This is escape-proof hospital." I said, "Really? Oh." That gave me a new thrust for life. And I began planning my escape. And I found a way to get through a door, finally, after a couple weeks, and through a corridor, and through another door, and across the yard, and over the fence. And I was gone. The fox was loose in West Texas. But the trouble is, why it is an escape-proof hospital, you don't know until you get out. But if you've ever been to West Texas, you realize they can see you running for 3 days out there. "Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. Get him, Charlie." They brought me back and gave me a couple months of electric shock treatments for that. That was their therapy for escape. But then, about that same time, the state of Texas, in their wisdom, passed a law that if the person who committed you would agree to take responsibility for you, you could have them back. So it increased the warmth of my letters home, I'll tell you. "Oh, honey, I just miss you so much. I realize I've been so bad," and on and on. I finally lured her down to Big Spring, where she got me out of the nut house. And we moved to Dallas, where I got a big job. I shouldn't have got a big job just out of the nut house, but I had good samples. And that's when I knew that there, when I committed suicide, I bet my wife was going to turn me in, and I was going to go back to the nut house. So I had to escape. And I got a car that was supposed to be delivered to Los Angeles, and I drove that as fast as I could. Got to El Paso the first day, 300 miles across the desert, which is pretty good. And then I had to hide my car because I had everything I owned in it, because there was nothing left in our house in Dallas. My stuff was all in the front porch, so it was easy to pack. And I put in the car, and I got to El Paso, and I had to find a place to hide it. But I used to live in El Paso, so I knew some good hiding spots. And I hid my car. And then I went to Juarez, where I am a living legend. Señor! And by midnight, I was standing at the bar, on the top of the bar of the Chinese palace, singing my song, "Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua." And they were clapping and cheering. And the next day, I had to get and got that damn car. And I get going fast. So I got as far as Phoenix, where I didn't know anybody. And it took me 2 hours to find a safe place to park it. Because all my clothes were in, all my money, all my ID, everything. And I know it was a good place because I haven't found it since. So I was here. I was on the street, drunk. "Help me find my car, pal." I said, "Don't bother me." I said, "Come on, for God's sakes, help me find my car. I got to find it." He said, "Don't bother me." I grabbed his lapels, which was a bad habit. And he said, "You should have done that, boy." He took out his badge. Said, "I'm a police officer. You're under arrest." And they threw me in the Phoenix jail. And I laughed later when he said, "We're going to cool you off, boy." You don't really cool off in a jail. It's 140 degrees. But you get to sleep finally. And I got to sleep finally, and I woke up in the middle of the night so sick. Oh, God, I was sick. And I went in, threw up, and what I thought was the toilet. And I noticed I was on tile. I would like to give you some tips if you're new. If you must be sick on tile because it's cool. And after you throw up, you can lay down and put your cheek on the... Oh, God, that feels good. And if you have to throw up again, you just... But I was sleeping there on the floor, finally. And a guy came back, one of the trustees, said, "You son of a buck." He said, you kicked at me. And he said, you vomited on my bunk. And I didn't mean to. I don't think he meant to do it, but he kicked out my front teeth. I got out in the morning at 6 in the morning when they let all the scallywags out. And my mouth was bleeding. I had no car, I had no clothes, no ID, no nothing. But I didn't know why I wanted to get to Los Angeles. I didn't know anybody there. But I finally hustled some old lady in a club for a bus fare to get to Los Angeles. And I got to Los Angeles. And the bus depot at that time was in the middle of Skid Row, down on 5th and Los Angeles Street. And I got off and I knew that I could make it here. I didn't know Los Angeles was this friendly. And I went to a nearby, to something called the Midnight Mission. I said, I'd like to have something to eat. And they said, "We're not serving now." I said, "I want something to eat, for God's sakes. I'm not serving now." And I said, "Move out." So I moved out. And I wandered around for a while. Finally, I thought, good idea. Where's a club? There's always somebody in the club who's soft-hearted. And I found out where the 6300 Club was. And I walked those 7.5 miles in the rain. And that's where George was lurking, too, at that time. And stayed sober. I didn't intend to stay sober. But the manager of the club said, "Boy," he said, "you're a mess." He said, "I can't have you running around here. You're not even supposed to come in unless you're a member. But you got to come in. But I got 3 rules for you." A man named Sullivan. You can't ask anyone for money, which you've already done. Secondly, you got to do what we tell you. And thirdly, you got to go to a meeting every night in our club. And I thought, oh, this is a cruel and unusual punishment. But I sat in the meetings, and I didn't get much out of them, I guess. I don't guess. But I went and sat there because they had donuts and cake. And I was living on donuts and cake then at that time, kind of a high perk diet. And eventually they assigned a man to be my sponsor, a guy named Bob Bailey. And he didn't have anybody that he sponsored. He was staying sober. But he was a big celebrity. He had a radio program called Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, that played all over the country. And he said, I'm going to be your sponsor, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. I said, sure, Bob. And he said, I'll call the club when I'm going somewhere, and you'll be out in the street when I get there. So I didn't know what he meant talking about even. But he called the club. He said, tell that kid to be out in the street at 6:30. I was out in the street at 6:30. He pulled up in his big Lincoln. Get in. We went and found a restaurant where he could bought me some scrambled eggs. I couldn't eat anything harder than that. And then we went to a meeting where he talked. And he did a lot of speaking. He did this maybe 10 consecutive nights, picked me up and take me out where he was speaking. But he did a lot of speaking, but his problem was he always did exactly the same talk. The same gestures, same everything. After a week, I could do it better than he could. But I didn't want to say anything to make problems. But one thing I hated about it, on the way back to the club after this meeting, he would give me a pep talk on God. And I didn't want to hear that. Because I was raised in a strong God-fearing place in Wisconsin, a Norwegian Lutheran church. And I knew that God didn't like me because I was a bad person. I had one of the things that I never could clear off my conscience. I was in jail one night when my son died, and that just killed me. I had 3 little girls and 1 little boy, and he died, and I was in jail. I couldn't, And nobody ever let up on that one. But I got out of that mess, and I, on the way back to the club, as I say, he'd talk to me about God, or says, he was kind of in some kind of religious frenzy, I guess. And I didn't want to hear it anymore. I mean, I thought, how can I stop this little boob from talking about God all the time? Maybe I'll ask him some questions about AA. And he's such an egotistical guy, he'll take that should take it the whole mileage all the way back. So on the way back the next night from Westwood, I said, Bob, I really admire your program. And I think I've told you before, I'm not really an alcoholic. I just have emotional problems. And I drink to soothe them. And to this day, I think that's absolutely true. I didn't see myself as an alcoholic. I saw myself as a person who drank alcohol because it soothed the ruptures of my life. And I didn't know then what I know now. And I said, what do you think is wrong with me, Bob? I got all these feelings and emotions and just eating me up and I can't drink. What do you think is wrong with me? He says, I think you're an alcoholic. I said, how could I be an alcoholic when my problem isn't really alcohol? It's all this crap going on. He said, kid, you just hit the golden words there. So many people today don't know what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is not a person whose problem is alcohol. If that were the case, we'd just all quit and be home free. A person is an alcoholic whose answer is alcohol. And when he gets in life, he gets to a point where it's either drink or go crazy or run away. And I thought, that can't be. But I thought about it all day the next day sitting around the club. That certainly fits me, because I've quit with or without a solemn oath. I've quit for good reasons. I quit for my dead son. I quit for everybody. But I always had to drink again. It got to be so unbearable to be sober. And it turns out that the curse of alcoholism is not that you're going to have trouble with alcohol. Is that alcohol is going to be called in pretty soon because your life is going to be untenable. Who would guess such a thing? And so I took that as a hypothesis. Maybe I'm an alcoholic, kind of. And I'll just do what he says for a little while. And he says, now we're going to work on the steps, kid. He said, I said, I can't work on the steps. He said, why not? I said, God hates me. And I hate God. He said, kid, I don't know about God, but you're not big enough for God to hate. You're just a punk. That hurts your feelings when you're down and out. But he was right, I think. And he said, all you have to do is find a power, and this is to you new people, find a power greater than yourself that you can turn your will and life over to. And he said, can't you do it with, you say you have this Norwegian background, can't you do it with the Norwegian Lutheran Church? I said, no. He said, can't you do it with the reading you've done? I said, no. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are, kid? I said, yeah. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because I believed that he was trying really to help me. And he became my higher power. And I did. I thought about that later. When I took a hypothesis of alcoholism, I did the first step. When I turned my will and my life over to my sponsor, that was the second step. Then you pray for knowledge of God's will for you. And that's just, what's your sponsor want now? I firmly believe that the most important factor I ever found, and any found I've ever seen, is sponsorship. Not because sponsors are wonderful above the level, but they are people who keep you accountable. If you have no sponsor, you're not accountable to anybody. Go to the meeting if you feel like it. Stay home if you feel like it. Have a home group if you feel like it. Don't go there if you don't want to go. Get up and say no to requests. But if you got a sponsor, somebody pretty soon says to you, what the hell's wrong with you? They're very cruel that way. My sponsor said to me, he said, I'm going to even try the third step with you. I want you to do the fourth step. And I'm going to write down all my crimes so you can turn it into somebody and I'll go back to the nut house. So I got a job as a dishwasher at the Gaiety Delicatessen on Sunset Strip. Very fancy. And I was washing dishes. I noticed that the busboys seemed to be bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. I'm very cunning that way. I thought, they're getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm not Mexican. So I just piled them up. The owner came over and said, aren't you going to do those dishes? I said, no, I'm not. They belong to the Mexicans. He said, you're fired. I said, but I'm an AA. He said, I don't give a shit. You're fired. And so I walked. A lot of us figure that membership in AA will purvey you above existing rules, but not quite. So I went back. They're showing me the time already. I was going to go into a dance later. But anyway, I went back to the club that morning and I felt so sad. I can't hold a job as a dishwasher, and I once upon a time was a brilliant man. And I went in and I said, everybody's going home from the meeting. I said, Sully, I got fired as a dishwasher. Other guys I got sober with, they got cars and girlfriends and places to live. And I'm living in an abandoned car and I can't even get hold a job as a dishwasher. I said, I might as well be drunk. He said, you're right. That's not the answer you're looking for, I'll tell you. He said, I'll tell you, this club has got about 120 members, I think. And about six of them like you. And the other 114 wish you would get drunk and die. And these poor six people have to defend you incessantly every time they come in. It might be a good idea to just think, if you'd get drunk, you'd punish all the 114 people, and you'd give them a bob of your hat. You might make them feel bad, the six, but that's good for them. I said, no, I'm not going to do that, Sullivan. I wouldn't give those people that right. Give me some paper. I got some paper, and I went in the back room, and I wrote an inventory. I didn't put in all the columns and what Mrs. Jones did or what Mrs. Smith did or anybody else did. But I put down a lot of crap about me that I'd almost forgotten. When I was a kid, I've been using people. And I'm dishonest intellectually, dishonest materially, financially. And I've had some big deals in my life, but I screw them up because I'm so eager and selfish. And I finished this whole thing. And I would suggest to you, if you're ever writing a fourth step, do it when you feel bad. Don't do it when you feel good. Because when you feel good, it's, well, I guess I screwed up a few times. Nothing serious. I want to see teardrops dropping on that paper. And I finally finished it. It's like I vomited. Cleanse. And I went outside and I said, well, Sullivan, I've read my inventory. You can tell a lot of 114 people that I'm out on the steps. I said, okay, kid. But he must have called my sponsor, because my sponsor called me the next morning and said, what's this I hear about you writing an inventory? Like I told you. I said, how did you find out? He said, we sponsors know. So he said, be out in the streets with your inventory at 6 o'clock, we're going to drive along the ocean into Oxnard. I'm going to give you a flashlight and you're going to read it. I said, no, I can't do that, Bob. There are certain things in there I haven't even come to a contemplation of it yet. I've got to find a way to resolve it in my mind. I don't want to hear that. Just get in this car at 6 o'clock. So I got in the car at 6 o'clock and he gave me a flashlight. We went along the ocean. 45 miles to Oceanside, and I read this, and oh, God. You know, I've heard a lot of inventory since then. None of them are quite so crappy as mine. Mine was even, I wish I were a bank robber or something. Hold up gas stations, do something, instead of just cheating somebody out of their money all the time. And I read this, got almost to Oxnard, and I said, that's all, Bob. He said, you're done now? He said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. That's my story of my life right there. But I took an inventory. And I had one. He said, I want you to start making amends to people. You are a rotten son of a bitch. I said, well, I don't mind making amends. He said, the biggest one you got is the University of Wisconsin, where you spoke at commencement, you got an incomplete in English history, and you didn't even get a diploma. He said, so you back there. I went back to visit my folks. I saved my pennies up for a bus fare. I went back to Wisconsin, and I went down there to see the regent. He was now the top man of the university. And I said, I said to his girl, I'd like to see the chancellor, please. She said, just a moment. I heard him say, tell him I'm not here. And that crap head, I'll punch him when I see him. And the next year I came back again to see my folks, and the same thing happened. And the third year, this is the last chance I was going to give him. I said, no, I'd like to see the chancellor, please. She said, oh, you were here last year, weren't you? I said, yes. And the year before that, she said, let me see what I can do. I heard him say, all right, send him in, I'll talk to him. And I went in and I said, you know, I really screwed up pretty badly here. And I want to make an amend. I want to do whatever's necessary if I can make it right. Maybe I can't do it right. What happened was, I went to the University of Wisconsin, and I was drinking heavily by that time. And I got an incomplete in my final semester on English history because they met at 8 o'clock in the morning. I just couldn't get up at 8 o'clock for nothing. So I just took the incomplete. And I spoke at commencement. Then we shuffled across the stage and got our degrees, and mine was blank. There's a note in it, you must take the English history in summer's extra schedule. So I had to go to school in the summertime. So I went to school in the summertime. I got a job at the U.S. Rubber Company balancing white sidewall tires. I had a job waiting for me teaching journalism at Duluth Denfeld High School. And I was really doing good, quite well, except for this damn going to school. But I used to stop by a bar every night, and I told these guys time after time, I was big at that university. I won a lot of trophies for that damn Wisconsin. I was on the national championship team, and I won a lot of things. They wouldn't hear anymore. They wouldn't hear. And one night a girl came in who I didn't know. And I could tell by looking at her, she wants to hear that story. So I sat her down, bought her a few drinks, and told her the story. She said, that seems odd. You say that you were doing so well. Now your face is smudged, your fingernails are dirty. You don't look very clean. I said, well, I'm just coming from work. You want to see how it happened? She said, yes. So we jumped in her car and drove to the campus. And, of course, it was all locked up at 1 in the morning. But I found a door where it had just those kind of frames, had glasses. So I broke one of those glasses with a rock and got in. And I took her upstairs to the trophy room. I opened the door and turned the light. Big, long trophy case, about two-thirds of it just me. She was overcome. She slumped to the floor. I thought, my God, she's had a flat tire. And I tried to pump her up, but a policeman's flashlight illuminated us. We got arrested. And breaking and entering in the nighttime is a charge that laid on me, which is an automatic 5 years in the state penitentiary in Wisconsin. And I don't know what they did to her. But thank God in the night, somebody got a hold of the cops and said, he's not a breaking and entering guy. He's just a drunk. Drunk poop. So they reduced it to drunk and disorderly conduct. But I remember sitting in the courthouse and waiting in the courtroom that morning waiting for the judge to come in, a friend of my dad's. That really makes it tough. And they finally came in. And while I sat there, a guy brought in a big box. I said, "What's in the box?" He says, "For Emmerslund." I said, "I'm Emmerslund." And all my school books, all my papers, all everything out of my locker was in there. A note on top saying, "I can't cover you for you this one. This is too much. You're expelled." So I was expelled after I graduated. That was kind of tough. And the judge gave me the same old lecture again. "Why do you do that? You have such potential." I would like to meet an alcoholic someday who doesn't have any potential, just to give him a clap on the back. And but I had to get a job. I now didn't have a job. So I got a job in this new newspaper writing sports. Because I know sports pretty well and I'm a good writer. And I doing well, drinking heavily, but doing well. And I met a girl with black hair, like black flashing eyes, totally unlike anything you see in the Lutheran church where they're all blondes. And they say, "Huh?" But she was mysterious, this girl. And she won my heart, and we were married. And after the marriage, she finally dropped a big one on me. She said, "I'm Catholic." Lutherans don't like Catholics, but I'll make an exception in your case. And we got along quite well. I had a bottle of vermouth and a bottle of gin. I could come home at night, make a martini, drink as many as I wanted to until I slumped into my bed. Great. It was the best part of my life, I always thought. And then my wife began manifesting the behavior pattern of Catholics that I knew nothing about. She began grinding out those kids, just boom, boom, boom. I said, "What the hell is this now?" She tried to explain it to me, but I didn't want to hear it. But I had to get better jobs, so I got a job in a big publishing company in the advertising department. And I wrote very good stuff, and they went to the top pretty quick. I got another job in a big manufacturing company as director of their advertising program. And I was really doing well, but my drinking was catching up with me. I pretty soon I couldn't get to work, and I wound up in an advertising agency that handled the Borden account. If any of you are old enough to remember Elsie Delmer, the Borden cows, I used to write what they said to each other, which wasn't much. Moo, moo. But I had worked for years to get to that level. And I was in Dallas, living in Dallas, and working for a big advertising agency. And they called me in one day, and I got so sick of being called in year after year after year by one agency after another. He said, "You know, Clancy, you really write well." I said, "Thank you." He said, but not well enough. Yesterday we had the chairman of Frito's tour of this agency, and he told me that you were drunk in your office. And he's a religious man. He told me either you go or he goes and takes his account, $10 million account, with him. So that was choice there. So I got fired. And I didn't go right home because he dropped a terrible thing to say. He said, "I called your wife and told her we were going to do it to you today." I thought, "Oh, you shouldn't have done that. She just gives you a running start." But that's when I made the run for California. And that's where I wound up. In 1 week, one Monday, I went to work in an advertising agency in Dallas with a big car and a big home and big things. And a week later, I was living in an abandoned car outside of the 6300 Club in Los Angeles. I mean, it could get you that quick if you play your cards right. And I had no idea I'd stay sober. But I stayed sober, and my sponsor died, and I got another sponsor. I got another sponsor, and I kept doing things. And I wasn't a very nice guy, smart aleck, but I knew all about AA because I'd been around AA 10 years by that time. But now it's been it's hard to believe that next October, next Halloween, I will celebrate 60 years sober. That's a long time. Don't applaud. Money. But I can't believe I'm 99 either, so it's all you, or 90, whatever I am. Kind of hard being 90 in this world, you know. You have to practice. And you know, behind one of those trees out there is a guy in a long black robe, and he's got a scythe. There's that son of a bitch now. And you're gone. But thank heaven, Alcoholics Anonymous has been very kind to me. When I stayed sober 5 years, you got a nice collection of numbers there. My wife and children returned to me after 5 years of sobriety. That was kind of funny. I'd been going to a meeting every night. I came home at night and she'd meet me at the door and go. She wouldn't believe me after 5 years of sobriety. But she did finally believe me. And then one day I got a call from the Midnight Mission, that wretched place. Where they called up and said, do you know anybody who wants to run the mission? Our director just died. I said, Christ, no. She said, they don't pay anything. And you have no rights, but you can work here. And I would talk to my wife about it. I was lying in bed one morning in January. I thought, that'd be kind of fun to do that for a month or two. I told them I'd be back, and here I am. And so I went down to the board of directors and said, I'll be glad to do it for a month or two. And the union won't let me touch it. And I went down there and did it for a month or two. And I really enjoyed it because I was working, writing advertising, writing good stuff. But I was dull, bored. And you get in the middle of a Skid Row mission, that's exciting. Death and transfiguration and fights and stabbing, shootings and just stop it, stop it! And I really looked forward to going to work in the morning. And so I said I'd do it for another month or two. That was in 1974, and I'm still there. Tomorrow afternoon I'll be at the Midnight Mission in Los Angeles. I hope there's no fights. I try to do it with the August of my being now. Really, boys, don't do that anymore or I'll kick your ass. But I found I live in a nice home. I have another two more children came. I have five kids and we live in a home we own. It's a nice part of town out by the ocean. Are you leaving? He gave me a note, said goodbye. Keep going to meetings, kid. Get a sponsor. I've had two good sponsors. My last sponsor was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain, who was my sponsor for 20-some years. And he tried to turn me into being a fairly good person. Fairly good. And today I get up every morning into a world in which I'm safe and sane and sober. I want to just talk about that a minute, because of all the steps, the 11th step to me is a critical one. Having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we try to carry this, that is the 11th step. Sought through prayer and meditation to, well, I didn't meditate long enough. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as you understand him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for you and the power to carry it out. And I thank God every night of my life. Thanks for keeping me sober a lot longer than I ever thought I'd stay sober. And thanks for getting me a living from some degree of dignity. Thanks for allowing me to start the Pacific Group, which is the biggest group in the world now. And they don't treat me with enough respect. But I pray to God every night following that prayer. I wish you would put someone in my life who will direct me into doing the things that will bring me into being the kind of man I want to be. I want to be loving and kind and gentle. And if power comes with it, I want to use the power wisely and well. But if you're new tonight, it's a good thing to remember. You are safer tonight than you've been in. You can't remember when. You're in the middle of a group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you are sober. And your head isn't crazy. So you're sane. So tonight, you and I have something in common. I've got almost 60 years. You may have 60 hours. I am glad to be here tonight for the 24th time to say I am very grateful that I'm safe and sane and sober. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was the overall chairperson in 2002.
I got to see from what my name is. My name is Vince, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was overall chairperson in 2006.
Thank you, Clancy, for giving a great AA talk. In the spirit of Rule 62, which is not to take ourselves too seriously, it is our custom on our anniversary night to have an entertainment spot.
Please help me welcome Lindsay, Maggie, Ellie, and Wilma, who will sing We Do.
Hello. I was just making sure the mic worked. Thank you.
So, Lindsay, how did you get sober?
Oh, that's an interesting story, Ellie. I'll tell ya.
We do.
I wobbled out of the speakeasy in Midtown that day.
Bar we do.
And I passed by the church on 60th with this calm man. He sometimes told me slogans and read me these things. Because he knew I had a real drinking problem. He told me that I should listen to the message that day.
Pray we do.
So I was just about to, you know, walk on by.
Bad for you.
When suddenly, and without warning, there was this spiritual experience. It got so bright, and there were all these voices saying, you never have to drink again.
We do.
I suddenly realized I had taken my first step.
Yeah, we do.
So I came to believe in that power above.
She took step two.
I could have sworn it would have been harder, but that calm man, he gave me a big book that could have cost $9.95.
Sha la 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 la.